We are Deuteronomy 1 today. And if you remember from 2 weeks ago when we did the intro to Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy 1 through 4 is the historical, it's called the historical prologue. And if you remember, it's the part of a Hittite treaty, which is old. So that makes Deuteronomy being written earlier rather than later. And it was the part of a treaty that recounted the relationship between the master and the servant, the suzerain king and the vassal are the technical terms, okay? But the historical prologue would emphasize the strength of the master and the weakness of the, you know, the underling in the treaty, the vassal or the servant, okay? So in Deuteronomy, that's going to be chapters 1 through 4. But Deuteronomy is a little different because this is not a new covenant. It's not a new treaty. The original treaty was made at Sinai. Okay, so this is not brand new, but it is going to recount the history from the time of the original covenant to now, to why are we doing this again? Okay, why do we have to renew the covenant? So that's what this, the content of these chapters is going to be. So Moses is going to repeat a lot of info from Exodus and Numbers, but there are differences. Right? Because Moses' purpose is different. So he's going to emphasize different things, maybe leave some stuff out, put some new information in, because he's trying to make a specific theological point to the second generation. Okay, so we're going to note some of those differences as we go through, because he has a different purpose. It's kind of like the Gospels, especially the Synoptic Gospels, right? They're all telling basically the same story, but they include something different or leave something out or emphasize something because they all have different purposes in writing. Okay, so this is the same, now it's the same author, Moses, but he's going to have different purpose in writing in Deuteronomy, so it's going to be a little different. A lot of it's going to be the same, but some of it's going to be different. Okay, his part of his emphasis in Deuteronomy is the covenant potential and covenant failure, right? He's going to present the second generation with, this is the covenant. You have all this great potential, but oh, look at your parents. And what happened? They fell flat on their face, right? And failed. And these are the consequences if you fail the covenant, if you break the covenant, right? Case in point, your parents. Okay, so by this point, Israel has already failed, already totally broken the covenant. So that's why Deuteronomy is necessary. Now the second generation, they get their shot at it. The first generation, they failed utterly. So now the second generation gets their chance. Okay, so they need to know what's going to happen if they obey and what's going to happen if they disobey. So the history of Israel is key to this moment. Okay, it's like second generation, your parents failed. Now the weight is on you. What are you going to do? Are you going to choose to obey, or are you going to choose to follow in the footsteps of your parents and disobey and fail God again? Okay. So that's why Moses goes through all this history of Israel, because it's this second generation would have lived some of it, but they wouldn't necessarily have lived all of it. If you remember, the oldest person in this generation is going to be like 59 years old, which is not that old. Except for Caleb and Joshua. They're the two exceptions. But everybody else at Sinai was either a child or was not even born yet. I mean, you're going to have, because they wandered for 40 years. So you're going to have 20, 30-year-olds that at Sinai, they wouldn't have even existed yet. They wouldn't have even been born. They would have been born sometime in the wilderness wanderings. So they need to know the history of everything that happened before so that they hopefully will learn their lesson. Okay, this pattern of defining, recounting Israel's history to give weight or to the present moment or explain the present moment, this is used throughout the Old Testament. Okay, Psalm 78, if we could go there really quick. We're not going to read it because it's long, but okay. Psalm 78 is I mean, my subtitle is God's Guidance of His People in Spite of Their Unfaithfulness, right? And he start the psalmist, Asaph, starts with Jacob in verse 5. He goes through the son, right, verse 12, in the land of Egypt. Verse 13, he divided the sea, right? 17, yet they sin against him. He talks about the manna. I mean, he is recounting all of Israel's history, all the way to verse 70, where it's he chose David his servant. Okay, so this psalm is starting from Jacob, Israel, and going to Egypt and recounting Israel's unfaithfulness and how they disobeyed, right? And then he's ending in David, God choosing David as king, right? And Israel's history matters. The covenant matters. What God has done matters to get us to the point of David, right? Because David is in the line of the seed. And remember, all the way back from Genesis, we're constantly looking for the seed. And so this is the line that is leading up to it. Israel's history matters. Okay, Daniel 9. It's when Daniel is obviously in captivity, and he's praying, and he confesses the sins of Israel as a whole. And he recounts Israel's history and basically says, God, we deserved exactly what we got. Because back in Deuteronomy, you said if we... Right? Don't obey. We're going to go into exile. Oh, look, we're in exile and we deserve it. So Daniel is confessing the sins of the nation as a whole, recounts their history, right? And says, that's how we got to this place of being in exile. Nehemiah 9, same deal. It's when they're back in the land. Israel has returned, Judah at least has returned from exile, part of them. And all of Israel recounts their history. Why are we at this moment? Well, because we were unfaithful, we disobeyed, so then God exiled us just like he said we would, and now we're back in the land, and they are also confessing their sins. So this pattern of Israel's history being recounted to make a certain point or to explain the present moment is used throughout the Old Testament. Okay. It's also in the New Testament. If you remember Acts 7, Stephen's speech, right? Before he gets stoned, what does he do? He goes all the way back and recounts Egypt and and God bringing him out. And then he basically gets to the point and says, you killed Jesus just like you killed all the other prophets before, right? And then that's what makes him really mad. And that's what gets him stoned. But he uses Israel's history even all the way up through Christ to make the point that, see, Israel, you have had a heart of unbelief the entire way, and you are no different now, and that's why you have missed Messiah. Why? Because Israel's history matters. Israel's history explains the present moment. Okay? Questions?
I did a
question.
Yes.
Yes.
I have listed a preamble.
Yes. That's going to be verses 1 through 5.
1 to 5. I was thinking it was chapters. Never mind.
Yes. No, that's okay. And we're going to deal with that first. So the preamble, it's just like the introduction, is verses 1 through 5 of chapter 1. And then the history, the historical prologue really starts in verse 6 of chapter 1. But it's only the first 5 verses are intro. Good. Any other questions? No. Okay, can someone read for me the first 5 verses, Deuteronomy 1, 1 through 5?
These are the words which Moses foretold Israel across the Jordan in the wilderness, in the Arabah opposite Suf, between Paran and Tophel, and Laban and Hazeroth and Dizahab. It is 11 days' journey from Horeb by the way of Mount Seir to Kadesh Barnea. In the 40th year, on the first day of the 11th month, Moses spoke to the children of Israel according to all that the Lord had commanded him to give them. After he had defeated Sihon, king of the Amorites, who lived in Heshbon, and Og, the king of Bashan, who lived in Ashtaroth and Edrei. Across the Jordan in the land of Moab, Moses undertook to expound this law, saying...
Okay, so these are the words. That's the name of the book of Deuteronomy in Hebrew, always the first couple words of the book. These are the words, but this Deuteronomy is in the form of a Hittite treaty, but it is much more than just a treaty. And we talked about this 2 weeks ago as well. This is a sermon. Okay, these are the words. This is Moses' final sermon, right? At the end of Deuteronomy, Moses dies. Okay, because he's not allowed into the land. So these are his final words. All parts of Deuteronomy are the sermon, even the laws that we don't quite understand. Okay, or think, why in the world is it there? It's all theological. It is all part of the sermon. The laws are the application of the sermon. Okay, so Moses speaks these words to all of Israel. Most likely, remember, Israel's huge, about 2 million people. Okay, so probably he spoke it to the leaders and then they conveyed it on. But the point is that this is applicable to everyone. Okay, this is not just the leaders. You need to be extra special and you need to live extra righteous lives. No, this is for everybody. All of Deuteronomy is applicable to all of Israel. It is a national endeavor. All of Israel has to go in and conquer the land, right? Not just the leaders. The covenant is for all of Israel, okay? Not just leaders, okay? This is important because all of Israel needs to go in and conquer the land. That's corporate, but whether they're successful or not is very individual, right? Because it's if they individually, vertically obey, right? If you remember in Joshua, the sin of one man, right? Brings all of Israel down. The sin of Achan, when he takes something that God has told him specifically not to take. The sin of one man, right? And then they go out and fight, and they lose. And they're like, what happened? Why have we lost, right? Well, it was one man. So this is corporate, and it's individual. Corporately, they need to take the land, but that is going to be dependent on each individual's obedience to the law, okay? Then he said, okay, so Moses is speaking to all of Israel, and then we have a bunch of geography, okay? Across the Jordan in the wilderness, in the Arva, opposite Suf, between Paran and Tophel, Laban, Hazarot, and Dizahab. Okay, we don't know exactly where all these places are. Obviously, we know where the Jordan is, okay? But the idea is that they're on the brink of the promised land. Failure and the wilderness is behind them. Okay, it says across the Jordan in the wilderness. We know they're specifically in the plains of Moab, but Moses' point is you have failure behind you of the wilderness and the wandering for 40 years. You have the promised land in Canaan across the Jordan ahead of you. This is your moment, Israel. What are you going to do? Are you going to go back to the wilderness like your fathers? Or are you going to trust God and believe and cross the Jordan and take the promised land? Okay, so that's the idea, okay? This is the key moment. Israel has a choice to make. What's it going to be? Moses is going to give his final shot, his final message. Then he's going to die. And it's going to be up to Joshua and Israel to decide what they're going to do next. Verse 2, this verse kind of cracks me up. Okay, Horeb, if we remember, Deuteronomy uses Horeb. Horeb just means Sinai. Okay, we typically know it as Sinai, but Horeb and Sinai are the same. Okay, Kadesh Barnea, that's where they send the 12 spies in from. How long does it take to get from Horeb to Kadesh Barnea? Well, read it. What does it say? 11 days. Is that very long?
No,
not really. Okay. So it should take 11 days to get from Sinai to the brink of the promised land. How long did it take Israel?
40 years.
Okay, now granted, they got to Kadesh Barnea, then they failed again, and then they had to wander for 40 years. But the idea is, it should have taken you about 11 days to get from the first covenant, right, the covenant at Sinai, to enter the promised land. But because you were stubborn and rebellious and didn't believe, it took you 40 years to do what should have taken you 11 days. Okay, that's the idea there. The point is, second generation, you don't want to make the same mistake. Should have taken your parents only 11 days. It took them 40 years, and most of you weren't even born yet during this time, or at that time. Okay, so don't be like your parents. Verse 3, and then it emphasizes it, right? In the 40th year, on the first day of the 11th month. Okay, this is emphasis on Israel's disobedience. It took them 40 years instead of 11 days. Okay, first day of 11th month. This is 2 months before Passover, 2.5 months before Passover, right? Passover is the 14th day of the first month. So this is, they have the 11th month, the 12th month, and then Passover will be halfway through the first month. Okay, so the idea here is Israel can enter Canaan when God wants them to enter, because what is Passover a commemoration of? From? And what did God do? Right. That's right. He demolished Egypt. So the idea is Passover, God demolished Egypt. What can God now do to Canaan? Defeat them. Right? So let's go to Joshua. Can someone read me Joshua 5, verses 10 to 12?
So you said it's 2.5 months from this day until Passover.
Yes, yes. Because Passover is the 14th day of the first month. So they have all of month 11, all of month 12, and then 14 days of month 1. Someone read Joshua 5, verses 10 to 12. Joshua 5, verses 10 to 12.
The sons of Israel camped at Gilgal. They observed the Passover on the evening of the 14th day of the month on the desert plains of Jericho. On the day after the Passover, on that very day, they ate some of the produce of the land, unleavened cakes and parched grain. The manna ceased on the day after they had eaten some of the produce of the land, so that the sons of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate some of the yield of the land of Canaan.
Okay, so they have crossed the Jordan River, they have entered the promised land, and they celebrate Passover, right? Then they eat some of the fruit of the land, the manna stops. Manna has been going for 40 years. Okay, now they're in the land, the manna stops. What happens in chapter 6 of Joshua? No. Good guess. What happens in chapter 6? Jericho. Okay, so after they celebrate Passover, then they really start the conquest of the land. So once they have been reminded of what God did in Egypt and how he demolished Egypt, then after that celebration, then they go and they start the conquest of Jericho, right? And who fights the battle of Jericho? Right, not them. All they do is walk around in circles, right? Okay, so Moses is saying to the second generation, the timing is perfect, right? You have time at the end of Deuteronomy. I think they mourn for Moses for 30 days, right? But then that still gives them time to gear up, get across the Jordan, celebrate Passover, and then really begin the conquest, okay? So the timing is perfect. Moses is careful to record the exact day because this is the day that Moses becomes accountable to God. Okay? On this day where he renews the covenant with them, Moses facilitates that in Deuteronomy. Okay? End of verse 3, it says, Moses spoke to the children of Israel according to all that the Lord had commanded him to give them. Okay, so this is Moses' sermon, but this is not just Moses' opinion. Okay, these words come from God himself. They are God's words, very authoritative. Israel must obey. Okay, this is not an option. I mean, they always have the choice, right? But what's going to happen if they choose badly, poorly? Okay, verse 4. After he had defeated Sihon, the king of the Amorites, who lived in Heshbon, and Og, the king of Bashan, who lived in Ashtaroth and Edrei. Okay? So this is just to remind us that Israel has already had some experience in war and has already had some victories. Right? God already helped them defeat the kings in Transjordan, and then that made 2.5 tribes want to settle in Transjordan. Okay? So God has already helped them defeat some of their enemies, and God, it's a reminder that God will continue to give them victories in Canaan, that God is truly with them. Look, even in your very recent past, God has been with you. Verse 5, across the Jordan in the land of Moab, Moses undertook to expound this law, saying, okay, expound means to make something absolutely clear or plain. Okay? To make something absolutely clear or plain. This is what exposition is supposed to be, even in today, right? When preachers when they speak expositionally, they expound on God's word, it's supposed to help us understand to make it crystal clear. Okay. To expound this law, that word for law in the Hebrew is Torah. Okay, this is an exposition of the law. It's not just a repeat. Okay, the purpose of the law is to change Israel into the witness that God intends them to be. Okay, their whole existence, the whole purpose of their existence is to be a witness to the other nations, to be a blessing, right? Land, seed, and blessing was the Abrahamic covenant. Israel was to be a blessing. Through him, through them, all the nations of the world would be blessed. Okay, how is Israel going to be different? How are they going to be righteous? How are they going to be holy? How are they going to be set apart? Enter the law. Okay, success in Canaan really had nothing to do with Israel's military, right? It has everything to do with their covenant relationship with God. Are they going to remain in that covenant? God will fight for them. Are they going to rebel and go their own way? God will not God will not fight for them. And remember, we said in Numbers, if God is against you, no one can be for you. It doesn't matter who you have on your side, you're going to fail if God is against you. Okay? So, God's words and laws are rooted in Israel's history. Law and history have to be understood together. Okay? So that's what Moses is going to do next. He is going to remind Israel of her history and how they got to the point where they're at right now. God's words and laws are rooted in Israel's history. Okay, history matters. History is theology lived out. Right? Our faith is based in history. It is not based in just, you know, some religion. Our faith is rooted in the actual historical death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Right? If he did not really die and raise historically, then Paul says we are most to be pitied, right? So history is very important. Questions? The first five verses. All right, can someone read for me verses 6 through 18?
The Lord our God spoke to us at Horeb, saying, "You have stayed long enough at this mountain. Turn and set your journey and go to the hill country of the Amorites and to all their neighbors in the Arabah. In the hill country, and in the lowland, and in the Negev, and by the seacoast, the land of the Canaanites, and Lebanon as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. See, I have placed the land before you. Go in and possess the land which the Lord swore to give your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, to them and their descendants after them. And I spoke to you at that time, saying, I am not able to bear the burden of you alone. The Lord your God has multiplied you, and behold, you are this day as the stars of heaven for multitude. May the Lord, the God of your fathers, increase you a thousandfold more than you are, and bless you just as he promised you. How can I alone bear the load and burden of you and your strife? Choose wise and discerning and experienced men from your tribe, and I will appoint them as your heads. And you answered me and said, the thing which you have done, or have said, is good, to do is good. So I took the heads of your tribes, wise and experienced men, and appointed them heads over you, leaders of thousands and of hundreds and fifties and of tens and officers for your tribes. Then I charged your judges at that time, saying, hear the cases between your fellow countrymen, and judge righteously between a man and his fellow countrymen, or the alien who is with them. You shall not show partiality in judgment. You shall fear the small and the great alike. You shall not fear man, for the judgment is God's. And the case that is too hard for you, you shall bring to me, and I will hear it. And I commanded you at that time all the things that you should do."
Okay, so verse 6 is technically the start of the historical prologue. Okay, and Moses starts at Sinai, because this is where the covenant was initially made. Okay, so this is the beginning of how Israel ended up where they are now. Beginning at Sinai, Moses is going to show that God has been faithful over and over and over again to Israel and to the covenant, and that Israel has not. Okay. He starts out with the Lord our God, or Yahweh our God. So there is already a covenant relationship between God and Israel, right? Because Moses starts with at the end of Sinai, where God says, you have stayed long enough. So that's after the covenant has been made, the law has been given, and God is saying, move on to the promised land. Okay? To fully live out the covenant, Israel needs to move towards Canaan. They can't just camp out at Sinai. Okay? The law is given at Sinai, the covenant is made at Sinai. But now, to fully live out the promises of God, they need to actually get into the promised land, which he promised Abraham. Okay, so that's what God says. You've stayed here long enough at this mountain. Okay, notice Moses says, remember he's speaking to the second generation, the Lord our God spoke to us at Horeb. Okay, technically, the people that he's talking to were either very young, the oldest they could have been is probably 18 or maybe 19, okay? Or, so they were young or not even born yet, okay? But Moses speaks to them like they were there and like they were adults. I mean, some of them were little kids too. It's the solidarity of Israel. Each new generation has to live out the covenant, and they need to be reminded of what happened in the past, what past generations have done. And it's as if they were there, right? Moses is going to speak to them as if they were there, which some of them would have been, but some of them would not have been. Verse 7, turn out and set your journey. Okay, this means to leave, disembark, disencamp. It's a key word. It indicates a new section. They're to leave behind Sinai and set your face toward a new destination. They were to leave Sinai and set their face towards Canaan. Okay? Go, where are they supposed to go? To the hill country of the Amorites, to all your neighbors in the Arava, in the hill country, in the lowland, in the Negev, by the seacoast, the land of the Canaanites, and Lebanon, as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. Okay, this is similar to Genesis 15, verses 18 to 21, when God promises Abraham Canaan, right? And he talks about all the way up to the Euphrates River. Okay, the Abrahamic covenant was a promise treaty. God made promises to Abraham. This is what I'm going to do for you, right? Land, seed, and blessing. You're going to get a land. You're going to greatly multiply, and you are going to be a blessing. The Mosaic covenant is an administrative treaty. It's how the promise treaty is actually carried out, right? If God's going to multiply them into a nation, and they're going to be a blessing to other nations, there's got to be a way to do that. How are they going to do that? Mosaic covenant. Through the covenant with God, through the law, through being example, being different than all the other nations. That is how they're going to be a nation, and how they're going to be a blessing to other nations, right? Because they are going to model for other nations what it looks like to have a right relationship with God. At least they're supposed to. Okay. 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 The Abrahamic covenant is a promise treaty, right? God made specific promises to Abraham, and what did Abraham have to do? Nothing, right? I mean, but in the treaty, when the covenant was made, remember, Abraham cuts all the animals in half, right? And who walks through it? And only God, right? Only God goes through it. Why? Because God is going to carry out this covenant regardless of Abraham and what he does, right? So the Abrahamic covenant is very much a promise treaty. Abraham, I am setting my promises on you, whether you like it or not. There's nothing you can do about it, okay? I'm going to do this. I'm going to give you land. I'm going to give you seed, multiply you, and the one seed from Genesis 15 is also going to come through you, and you are going to be a blessing to the nations. The Mosaic covenant is an administrative treaty. How do those promises actually get carried out? How is Israel supposed to operate as a nation? How are they going to be a blessing to those around them, right? How are they even going to get the land? They're going to have to come in and, you know, divide up the land, and then they're going to have to live as a nation, as a society. How is that all going to work out? That's the Mosaic covenant. Okay? Right, a nation needs land in order to make an international impact. If you remember all the way back to Genesis 11, God mixes up languages and makes nations to be a restraint on sin, right? Because the problem was everybody spoke the same language. God says, go fill the earth. The people said, nah, we don't want to. We're going to all just live in one place, and we're going to look. We're going to build a tower to heaven. God says, huh, that's funny. I have to come down to even see your puny little tower, right? What am I going to do? I'm going to change your languages. So you are going to form nations to make it hard for you to collaborate, so sin is restrained. Now that we have nations, God is going to choose one nation in order to have an international impact. That nation needs to have land. That land is Canaan. Okay? Now is the time. We are going to renew the covenant, the Mosaic covenant, the administrative covenant. You are going to enter the land, and I'm going to tell you exactly how you need to live. Okay? After Sinai, they were supposed to possess the land, enter the land. It was only 11 days from Sinai to Kadesh Barnea, right? But clearly that didn't happen because here we are with the second generation and they're still not in the land, okay? So the second generation gets a chance to act in faith and obedience. This is the moment, again, what is Israel going to do, okay? Their parents failed. It's their chance. What are they going to do now? That verse 8, see, I've placed the land before you. Go in and possess the land which the Lord swore to give to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, to them and their descendants after them. Okay? This is what Moses said to the first generation, right, when they're going to Kadesh Barnea. But really now, the second generation gets the same message, right? Obviously, they're not in the land yet. they're still in Moab, technically still in the wilderness, right? Now they get the chance. They get the exact same chance their parents did. They're on the edge of the land. They're the brink of entering the land. What are you going to do? Okay. Was that clear, Joyce? Okay. Verse 9. Okay, now this is a little random. It seems a little random, right? Because Moses says, I spoke to you at that time saying, I am not able to bear the burden of you alone. Okay, so you would think Moses sets all this up, right? You're about to enter the land. You're on the edge of the land. You would think that we would get the story of the spies immediately, right? But we don't. We don't get that until verse 19. And in the middle, we have this interjection of the choosing of the leaders. Okay. Why? The question is why? Why do we need to know about the leaders? Okay, so the idea is the land, Canaan, needs to be populated with a people that have a witness. They need to live out righteousness. That's the entire point of Israel's existence, right? That they be an example to the world of what it looks like to live a holy, godly life. Okay, to do this, they need judges. They need leaders that are going to implement God's law and help people live righteous lives. Help people know how to live. Okay? So Moses says, I spoke to you at that time, right? At that time, right? This is in the past. This happened before you were born. It's flashing back to a different event. Okay? If you notice, I don't know what all your versions say, but in the NAS it says, I am not able to bear the burden of you alone. In the NAS, if you notice, the words the burden are italicized. It's because they don't exist in the Hebrew. What it says in the Hebrew is, I am not able to bear you alone. When we add the words the burden, it seems negative. In the Hebrew, it's a very neutral statement. It gets negative later on. But the initial statement that Moses is saying is not negative. Okay? It's neutral. He's just, there too, and because then in verse 10, he says, the Lord has multiplied you. Right, which is a good thing. It's a fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant. That's a blessing, right? But Moses is just saying, you got too big. I just couldn't do it by myself. That's not necessarily a negative phrase. So just, I don't know, does yours have the burden in ESV? The responsibility?
For verse 9?
Yeah. I'm not able to bear the burden of you alone.
I'm not able to bear you by myself.
Yes, so that's more of what the Hebrew says. Okay, so it's not, the emphasis is not, you're this heavy burden, right, and it's negative. It's a very neutral statement, okay? Because then verse 10 and 11 are very positive, right? Because God has multiplied you. It's a fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant. Okay, there, and this is a good thing because now we actually have people to populate the land, right? When it was just Abraham, it was just him and his little group of people. They're certainly not big enough to populate the land, so that's why God took them off to Egypt for 400 years to grow them into a nation. Okay, so this is why Moses needs help. God has kept his part of the Abrahamic covenant, and he will keep his promise to give them the land as well, right? He's already fulfilled, or at least partially fulfilled, the seed part of the covenant, the I will multiply you part of the covenant. Okay, so when God has done that part, you can trust him that he's going to do the rest as well. Verse 11, Moses asks God to keep going, right? May the Lord, the God of your fathers, increase you 1,000-fold more than you are and bless you just as he has promised you. God has multiplied you like the stars. Now I want him to keep going that you might get even more and more and more. The more people in Israel will enable the Mosaic covenant to work even further, right? The bigger Israel is, the bigger impact they can make on the world, the more they can be a blessing. The more God's glory will shine. Okay, so that's what Moses wants. Verse 12, this is when it turns negative. Okay, says, how can I alone bear the load and burden of you and your strife? That word for strife is contentions or complaining, like in the wilderness when they just complained over and over and over again. Okay? Israel was supposed to be part of the solution, right? God's redemptive plan for all of history. The problem is that Israel is also part of the problem. Okay, right? They have strife, they have complaining, so they are part of the problem as well. The idea behind this is that the solution for Israel, the solution to their problem, is also going to be the solution for the world's problem. Okay? Verse 13 through 15, Moses says, choose wise and discerning and experienced men from your tribes, and I will appoint them as your heads. You answered me, said, the thing which you have said to do is good. So I took the heads of your tribes, wise and experienced men, and appointed them heads over you, leaders of thousands, hundreds, fifties, tens, and officers for your tribes. Okay. So Moses turns to the people for help. He cannot deal with all their issues by himself. Okay. So they were to choose leaders that were wise and discerning and experienced. The people say, oh, great idea. Let's go along with this. Okay. Moses is emphasizing that the people are responsible for their life before God. Okay. They need help living righteous lives. They need help knowing what is the right thing to do. Okay, so they need leaders that are going to help them. This same story is in Exodus 18. Can someone read for me Exodus 18:21, please?
Moreover, look for able men from all the people, men who fear God, who are trustworthy and hate a bribe, and place such men over the people as chiefs of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens.
Okay, so here the men were to fear God, men of truth who hate dishonest gain. In Deuteronomy, they were to be wise and discerning and experienced. So it's a little different. Moses chooses different words to describe them. Okay, but somebody read for me Proverbs 9, verse 10. Proverbs 9, verse 10.
The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is insight.
Okay, so in Exodus, it says these men were to fear the Lord. In Deuteronomy, it says they were to be wise. But Proverbs links the two and says it's the same thing, right? To fear, wisdom begins with the fear of the Lord. You cannot be wise until you fear the Lord, okay? Wisdom is closely related to the laws and teachings of God. That is true wisdom, that you fear the Lord, and so then you're going to listen to what he says and do what he says. Okay? So, this is a plan that's bought in by everyone. They're supposed to, the people think it's a good idea, and Moses chooses wise and experienced men to lead them. Okay? verse 16. Then I charged your judges at that time, saying, hear the cases between your fellow countrymen. Okay, so the job of the judges, what are they supposed to do if there's a problem between fellow countrymen? In the Hebrew, it's literally brothers. Okay, it's as if Israel is one big family, one big happy family. Okay, there is to be dignity and the right treatment of each individual. Okay, verse 17, it's going to talk about don't be partial, okay? But first, they're a big family, and what is the first thing that Moses says to them? Hear the cases between your brothers or fellow countrymen and judge righteously, okay? The Mosaic Covenant is all about justice and righteousness, and this is going to help carry out the Abrahamic Covenant promises, okay? How are they going to be a witness to the world and a blessing to the world? Right? They are going to live righteous lives. Righteousness is transformative, right? True righteousness brings about change in your life, okay? In Israel, righteousness is established by the law of God. And judging righteously is something that God does. Can we go to Psalm? Can someone read for me Psalm 9, verses 4 and 8? Psalm 9, verses 4 and 8.
But you have maintained my just cause. You have sat on the throne judging righteousness. And he will judge the world in righteousness. He will execute judgment for the peoples with equity.
Okay, so this is talking about God, right? You maintain my just cause. You have sat on your throne judging righteously. This is what God does. Verse 8, he will judge the world in righteousness. He will execute judgment for the peoples with equity. Okay, so this is something God is going to do to the entire world, not just Israel, but Israel is to mirror God in this. He is to judge the world. God is going to judge the world righteously. Okay, when God judges the world in righteousness, he will restore the world to that which was lost in the fall. When God judges righteously, it transforms the world. And we see that in Isaiah. Can somebody go to Isaiah 11 and read for me Isaiah 11, verse 4? Okay, so God is going to, with righteousness, judge the poor, okay? Then, if you look down to verse 6, what time period are we talking about? The wolf will dwell with the lamb, the leopard will lie down with the young goat, the calf with the young lion, and the fatling together. What are we talking about? Millennium. The millennium. When God comes and judges righteously, what happens? Yeah, the whole world is changed, right? And we are back to what it was supposed to be like before the fall. Okay, so when God judges righteously, that righteous judgment truly transforms the world into what it should be. Okay, so what Moses is saying in Deuteronomy is that Israel needs not to just judge fairly, but make judgments that point back to God. They are to use the same judgments that God would pass down. That is how these judges are supposed to judge. No pressure. You're just supposed to judge exactly like God would. Okay? And it's to point to God who will one day come and judge righteously and transform the world. Okay? But Israel was always supposed to be a microcosm of how we're supposed to live, what truth really is. And it was always supposed to point back to God. And these judges, that was their job, to always point back to God and say, when we do things right, when we live rightly, right, that righteousness transforms us and we are closer to Eden, right? And we are trying to get, like we've always said, we're always trying to get back to Eden. And Eden will come again in the millennium, okay? For us, our personal righteousness does the same thing, right? In the New Testament, there's the emphasis on personal righteousness, right? We are to obey God because we love God. And our righteousness, others should be able to see our good deeds and do what? Right, glorify the Father in heaven, right? Because our righteousness should also point back to God and say, this is what happens to a person when they are transformed, and this is what God is going to do for the whole world, right? Our personal righteousness is not just between us and God, right? It is also supposed to have a horizontal impact that others can see. This is what it looks like to be back in Eden. A very small portion picture, right? So obviously we're not going to be perfect, but that's why our righteousness matters on more than just an individual level. Okay. Revelation 19:11. Can someone read that for me? Revelation 19:11. Okay, so this is Christ coming back, and what is he going to do?
Judge in righteousness.
So this is Christ at the end, ultimately judging righteously. Okay, so this is the end of the story. There will be righteous judgment over the earth, and the earth will be transformed, right? And will be changed. Okay, back to Deuteronomy, verse 16. The judges, they're to judge righteously between a man and his fellow countryman or the alien who is with him, always in the law, right? The foreigner is to be treated the same. Why? Because God's plan is global. It's not just for Israel. And Israel is supposed to be a picture of that, right? The Israelites don't get special treatment. The foreigners, they are to be treated the same as well. Okay. Verse 17. You shall not show partiality in judgment. You shall hear the small and the great alike. You shall not fear man, for the judgment is God's. Okay, so here it's saying, right, no partiality and no fear of man. All men are equal before God and deserve right judgment. Okay, Israel was to be different than the nations, and they were to be judged rightly regardless of money, power, or position. Okay, they were to not fear man. They were supposed to do what's right. I mean, I think it's Proverbs, right? That says you're not even supposed to favor the poor man, right? You're not supposed to have undue compassion on the poor man in a judgment. If they did what's wrong, right? You can't say, well, they were poor, you know, so we're just going to let them get by with it. And you can't do the same to the rich man. Oh, well, he's rich. And, you know, if I get on his bad side, then I'm going to be in trouble, right? Israel was to judge without partiality, regardless of which end of the spectrum you were on. Okay. Why? Because in verse 17, it says the judgment is God's. Truth, right and wrong, belong to God. They are not available to the highest bidder. Right? God is the authority. And Israel was to reflect God's judgment. Right? In our nation, our laws are made a lot of times based on whoever votes for what. So if we change our mind about something, right, we can just vote a new law in, theoretically. Or it can just be, whatever, mandated. Okay? That's not the way it was with Israel. God set the laws. So you knew it was absolutely right and absolutely wrong. Okay? It was God's judgment. And that is true judging in righteousness. And those are the laws that are transformative, not this is right today and wrong tomorrow, or wrong today and right tomorrow, because we as humans changed our mind about it. Okay. End of verse 17. The case that is too hard for you, you shall bring to me and I will hear it. Okay, so difficult cases were referred to Moses. Remember, Moses was the prophet that spoke to God face to face. God says he spoke to Moses like a friend. So the hard cases that, you know, maybe the application of the law was a little unclear, they couldn't figure it out, they were to bring him to Moses, and this would ensure that God's judgment would get passed down. Okay? That his judgment would get carried out because God spoke to Moses face to face. Verse 18, I commanded you at that time all the things that you should do. Okay? At that time, this is all that was commanded at Sinai. He's not just referring to the judges. Okay? The judges were to help Israel implement all the commands God had given them. Okay, the judging is seen as an application of the word or Torah of God to the people's daily life. So the their job was not just necessarily, you know, you wronged me, I'm going to sue you in court, right? This is how do we practically live out God's law day to day in our day to day lives. And that is the righteousness that is transformative when you are living out what is true. Okay, questions? Yes.
So I'm going back to why you had mentioned why this part is
yes.
Here.
Yes.
Because we don't know if these judges that were originally appointed at Sinai, if they are even still alive.
Oh, they wouldn't be.
None of them? If they were
they
under.
Well, they would have been. The oldest they could be is 19 at Sinai. Right, because that is when, after the spies, he says 20 and over, so they're not.
So then, since they're all dead, then the purpose of this, because it's quite an elaborate several verse recounting.
Yes.
Is, and having it first,
yes.
grabbing this correctly, is to set the stage for, even in the rest of the history, the righteous living and the judging righteously and the
yep.
places, blah, 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 should have been paramount.
Yes. Yes. And this is, and so we would assume that there are now judges that have replaced these judges, younger ones that now exist in the second generation as well, because Joshua's not going to be able to do everything, right? Because he's going to succeed Moses. But you are about to enter the land. And this is how you are supposed to live. You need to be righteous. We set up all these judges, and did your parents listen? Did it work? Were they righteous? Right? No, they weren't. And we know that in that first generation, there were some righteous that even still die out in the 40 years, right? Because you have the Levites that, you know, go out and fight after the golden calf in Exodus 32, right? And you have different ones responding correctly to different situations. So it's not that 100% of the first generation rebelled, but the vast majority did, and so then they were all judged together. But yes, you, Israel, it is paramount that when you enter the land that you live righteously. And that you obey God's law. Because when you don't, that's what's coming next. Okay? So we had this system set up. And they were to judge. And you were to live righteously. And now we're going to get into the spies at Kadesh Barnea. Okay? And so then, well, what's the rest of the story? What really happened? Okay? Now, second generation, pay attention. Because you're getting the same chance that your parents did at Kadesh Barnea. Plains of Moab, this is your Kadesh Barnea. What are you going to do? Are you going to obey? Are you going to live righteously? Are you going to do what's right? Are you going to believe God or are you not?
So do we know if every judge that died, they were replaced right away? Or
no.
Is this like the final spot? Like, okay, we need this set up before we enter the land.
I don't know. Okay, so what Moses is doing here, he's recounting what happened in the past. So he is not setting up new judges now. I don't know that we know exactly, but I would assume that once this judge dies, another one would have been appointed. I would assume that. But we don't know that for sure. Okay, what we do know is that the second generation, they do a good job, right? And Joshua, I think, says that as long as the leaders were alive, right? And I would assume it means these leaders, the judges. As long as they were alive, Israel followed the Lord. Okay, and then it was after they've all died out, and then we get the book of Judges. Okay, so, but this second generation does a good job. Now, do they do a great job training their children? I don't know about that, but good. Any other questions? All right, the next section is the rest of the chapter, 19 to 46. before we read it. This section is a chiasm. Does anyone remember what a chiasm is? That's right. The beginning and the end match each other, and the middle is the most important. Okay? So, verse 21. See, the Lord your God has placed the land before you. Go up and take possession. That's a command. God is telling them, go to the land. Okay? Verse 26. Yet you were not willing to go up, but rebelled against the command of the Lord your God. So, at the beginning of the story, God gives a command. Israel rebels. They don't do it. Okay? So that's the first thing. At the end of the story, this is the repeat of the beginning of the story, verse 42. And the Lord said to me, say to them, do not go up nor fight, for I am not among you. God gives Israel a command. Don't go into the land. Right? I'm not with you. Don't fight. Verse 43. So I spoke to you, but you would not listen. Instead, you rebelled against the command of the Lord. So at the beginning of the story, we have a command and rebellion. At the end of the chapter, we have a command and a rebellion. What's in the middle? Why are they rebelling? What is their problem? Verse 32, this is the whole point. But for all this, you did not trust the Lord your God. Israel does not believe. They do not believe God. That is why they rebel. This is their heart. Verse 32, this is the key to the mint. Okay? This is why Israel does, the first generation did everything they did. We look at them and we're like, ah! How do you not get it? Well, it's because they have a heart of unbelief. They do not trust God. Verse 32. Okay? So, can someone read for me? And we're not going to most likely finish today, but... verse 19 through 46.
Then we set out from Horeb and went through all that great and terrifying wilderness that you saw on the way to the hill country of the Amorites, as the Lord our God commanded us. And we came to Kadesh Barnea. And I said to you, you have come to the hill country of the Amorites, which the Lord our God is giving us. See, the Lord your God has set the land before you. Go up, take possession, as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has told you. Do not fear or be dismayed. Then all of you came near me and said, let us send men before us that they may explore the land for us and bring us word again by the way by which we must go up and the cities into which we shall come. The things seemed good to me, and I took 12 men from you, one man from each tribe. They turned and went up into the hill country, and they came to the valley of Eshcol and spied it out. They took in their hands some of the fruit of the land and brought it down to us and brought us word again and said, it is a good land that the Lord our God is giving us. Yet you would not go up, but rebelled against the command of the Lord your God. And you murmured in your tents and said, because the Lord hated us, he has brought us out of the land of Egypt to give us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us. Where are we going up? Our brothers have made our hearts melt, saying, the people are greater and taller than we. The cities are great and fortified up to heaven, and besides, we have seen the sons of the Anakim there. And then I said to you, do not be in dread or afraid of them. The Lord your God who goes before you will himself fight for you, just as he did for you in Egypt before your eyes. And in the wilderness where you have seen how the Lord your God carried you as a man carries his son all the way that you went until you came to this place. Yet in spite of this word, you did not believe the Lord your God, who went before you in the way to seek you out a place to pitch your tents, in fire by night and in the cloud by day, to show you by what way you should go. And the Lord heard your words and was angered, and he swore, not one of these men of this evil generation shall see the good land that I swore to give to your fathers, except Caleb the son of Jephunneh, he shall see it, and to him and to his children I will give the land on which he has trodden, because he has wholly followed the Lord. Even with me, the Lord was angry on your account and said, You also shall not go in there. Joshua, the son of Nun, who stands before you, he shall enter. Encourage him, for he shall cause Israel to inherit it. And as for your little ones, who you said would become a prey, and your children, who today have no knowledge of good or evil, they shall go in there. and to them I will give it, and they shall possess it. But as for you, turn and journey into the wilderness in the direction of the Red Sea. Then you answered me, we have sinned against the Lord. We ourselves will go up and fight just as the Lord our God commanded us. And every one of you fastened on his weapons of war and thought it easy to go up into the hill country. And the Lord said to me, say to them, do not go up or fight, for I am not in your midst, lest you be defeated before your enemies. So I spoke to you, and you would not listen. But you rebelled against the command of the Lord and presumptuously went up into the hill country. Then the Amorites who lived in that hill country came out against you and chased you as bees do and beat you down at in Seir as far as Hormah. And you returned and wept before the Lord, and the Lord did not listen to your voice or give ear to you. So you remained at Kadesh many days, the days that you remained there.
Okay, so in this section, Moses is recounting Israel's covenant failure. Okay, they absolutely failed multiple times at Kadesh Barnea. Okay, this explains why the second generation is where they are, right? Why is the second generation still not in the land? Well, because their parents failed.
I have a problem with 37.
Verse 37?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll get there. Maybe not today, but we will get there.
I think that wasn't quite true, but then you can't say that's not true because then the Bible's not true. Moses had his own sin.
He did, and we will get there. We will get there. Okay. So the second generation is where they are because their parents corporately failed, but the unbelief was also individual, right? It takes a bunch of individuals' unbelief to then not go in the land, right? If it was just one person that didn't believe and everybody else did, they would have made it into the land. Okay. This second generation can only learn from their mistakes if they actually understand what their mistakes were. Okay, remember, this second generation were children at Kadesh Barnea or not even born. Okay, that's where in verse 39, where it says, moreover, your little ones who you said would become prey and your sons who this day have no knowledge of good and evil. They were little, meaning they're not morally responsible for their parents' decisions, right? They had really no say in the matter because they're still children. So they couldn't say, no, dad, let's go into the land, right? They're kids. So those are the ones that are now inheriting the land, but they need to learn from their parents' mistakes, but they can't do that unless they understand what their parents' mistakes were. Some of them, like I said, were probably not even born at this point. Okay, so verse 19. Then we set out from Horeb. Again, Horeb, Sinai. So they set out, like verse 7, they're moving the camp forward. Okay, Sinai to Kadesh Barnea, about 100 miles. Again, should only have taken them 11 days. Now, granted, they're moving an entire nation, so maybe it takes longer, but still, it's not that long of a journey. Okay? Notice how Moses describes the wilderness and went through all that great and terrible wilderness. Okay? This emphasizes the faithfulness of God. He brought them through this really hard, terrible wilderness. He faithfully saw them through it. He brought them to Kadesh Barnea, which is on the edge of the promised land, so that they could go up and take the promised land. He has been faithful. He will give you the land. Israel, you should believe. That's the point. Look at this awful thing God brought you through. You can trust him, right? Be faithful. He is faithful. You need to believe.
Well, even with the story of King Sihon and Og,
yeah,
it's repeated so many times before Jericho falls.
Right.
And it's almost like, I mean, because he repeats it there in the beginning, then he repeats it again
yep.
in a couple chapters, and then it's again, I think, before Jericho.
Right, and so Joshua, yeah. Right.
Over and over.
It's like, hey, Israel, remember.
Major people that nobody thought you could
right.
see. And
right.
Yeah, he did.
Yep. Good. Verse 20. I said to you, you have come to the hill country of the Amorites, which the Lord our God is about to give us. See, the Lord your God has placed the land before you. Go up, take possession, as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has spoken to you. Do not fear or be dismayed. Okay, so Moses addresses the people at Kadesh. They're, like I said, the edge of the promised land. They're on the verge of entering Canaan. All that stands between them and Canaan is for them to do something, for them to act. All they got to do is say, yes, we're going to do it and enter the promised land. That's it. Nothing, there is no other barrier to overcome. This was God's agenda for the first generation, okay? For them to go up into the promised land. But because the first generation failed, now it is God's agenda for the second generation. They are at the same crossroads. All they have to do is cross the Jordan and go into the land. That's it. They just have to act in faith. That's all the first generation had to do. Okay? Verse 21, all of these are imperatives. Go up. Take possession. Do not fear. Do not be dismayed. Okay? They're commands. Israel, do this. This is not an option. God is giving you a direct command. Obey. Okay? He says, and God knows their hearts, right? He says, do not fear. This is a reaction against something eternal. This is a reaction against something external. There are already people in the land. God knows it. God's told them that from the very beginning, right? He's always said the land of the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Hittites, right? He's always told them there are people in the land and that he's still going to give them this land, right? But they have to trust God. That God is going to take care of the people. They are to not fear. They are to not be dismayed. This is more of an internal reaction, a sinking of the heart that you can do nothing about this. Dismay leads to no action, leads to I can't do this. Okay? If you fear the wrong thing, if you don't believe you're going to fear the wrong thing, what should be the one thing that they do fear? God. When you fear God, then you believe God and you will act in faith. When you do not believe God, then you are going to fear all the wrong things and you are going to make all the wrong decisions. You're going to fear the giants in the land and you are not going to act. Why? Because you have a heart of unbelief. Verse 22, then all of you approached me and said, let us send men before us that they may search out the land for us and bring back to us word of the way by which we should go up and the cities which we shall enter. The thing pleased me and I took 12 of your men, one man for each tribe. Okay. Does anybody remember this story from Numbers? Let's go to Numbers 13. Can someone read for me Numbers 13, verse 1? Verse 1 and 2. Okay, so in Numbers, what does it sound like? Who gave this command? Yes, but God. God says, right? The Lord spoke to Moses saying, send out for yourselves men to spy out the land. God says, go spy out the land. In Deuteronomy, who does Moses say it was? Whose idea was it? The people's idea. Okay, so in Deuteronomy, Moses is emphasizing the human side because it reveals who Israel truly is. So the question is, what really happened, right? Was this God's idea or was it man's idea? From Deuteronomy, it really seems like this is man's idea, right? And Moses thinks it's a good idea, and so God allows it. And God says, fine, go send out men, right? So Moses probably consulted God, and God says, go do it. And that's what's recorded in Numbers. God said, go do it. Okay? Here in Deuteronomy, it says that the people approached Moses, and they want to send men out before them. Okay? In verse 22 and 23, we can't tell if this is a good idea or not. The text doesn't indicate. Is this a good idea? Is this a bad idea? Is Israel rebelling in this? Are they trusting God in this? It's not very clear, okay? But what's interesting is what the people say the spies are going to do, okay? If you look at verse 22, it says, let us send men before us that they may search out the land for us and bring back to us word of the way by which we should go up. Okay? So what does it sound like the spies' job is to do? What are they supposed to do? Say it again. Find the best way in. Who should we attack first? Which direction should we come from? What's our military strategy, right? That's what it sounds like. Okay? We're going to go take the land. So we're going to spend spies in, and they're going to say, okay, we should go here and attack this city, and then we should go over here and attack this city, right? That's what it sounds like. Word of the way, okay? You need to pay attention to the word, okay? The spies are to bring us back to us word. We're going to see this word again, okay? Word of the way. So from this verse, it seems like they're supposed to lay out a military plan. This is how we best accomplish the conquest. Okay? And Moses approves of this. Verse 23, the thing pleased me, and I took 12 of your men, one man for each tribe. The question again is this a good thing or a bad thing? Is it good that Moses approved of it, or is it not? Did Moses make a mistake here? Was this part of the reason he's not entering the promised land? Okay? It's not clear in the text right here. Okay? So this is what happens. God says, go do it, right? We know that from Numbers. God said, go do it. So, verse 24. They turned and went up into the hill country and came to the valley of Eshcol and spied it out. Then they took some of the fruit of the land in their hands and brought it down to us. And they brought us back a report and said, it is a good land, which the Lord our God is about to give us. Now, if you're familiar with the Numbers passage, right? Here in Deuteronomy, Moses leaves out a whole bunch, okay? Because here it says that they go to the valley of Eshcol, which is near Hebron, okay, which is not very far into the land, okay. Hebron's kind of close to Jerusalem, so it's not very far up. In Numbers, it says they go all the way up. They go up past the Sea of Galilee, the spies do, and come back, okay. Here, because Moses has a specific purpose for including this, so he doesn't include all the details that he does in Numbers. So he just says they go to Hebron, Eshcol, Valley of Eshcol, they spy it out, they get some fruit, they bring it back, okay? Because that's all that's really important to this part of the story, okay? But Eshcol, right, they get fruit of the land. So even the little bit that Moses includes here, the promised land is vastly different than the great and terrible wilderness of verse 19, okay? In the promised land, there's fruit of the land. In Numbers, we know that it is grapes that they bring back, right? And I think figs, okay? So very different from the great and terrible wilderness that they've just been through.
They also call the land
Yes, in Numbers they do. Okay, now what's interesting is it says they... verse 25, they took some of the fruit of the land in their hands, brought it down to us, and they brought us back a report. That word in Hebrew is word. Okay, it's the same word that is used in verse 22 to bring us back a word of the way. Okay, so they're to go bring back a word. In verse 25, they bring back a word. I don't know what ESV, it says word. And it's the same word. So they bring back a word, and what do they say? Okay, it is a good land, right? But is that the word they were supposed to bring back?
No, that's what Joshua and Caleb brought back, but not the other time.
Okay, but what in...
They were supposed to bring back a report of how to get into there.
They were, right, they were supposed to bring back a military strategy. Did they bring back a military strategy?
No.
They
judged the land.
They judged land. And back in Numbers, right? Who told them the land was good? God did. So do you need people to go in and say, oh yeah, the land's good, God was telling the truth? No. The spy's job was to bring back a military report. They come back and they say, yeah, the land's good. And we know from Numbers, it's like, yeah, good, wink, wink, asterisk, but, right? So, because even in, I think it's Caleb, right, that says it's a land flowing of milk and honey in Numbers. But the point of how Moses is structuring this story in Deuteronomy is your spies failed. They didn't do what they were sent to do. But notice also in Deuteronomy that the spies only bring back a good report. Now we know from Numbers that's not everything they said, but Moses doesn't tell us what the rest of what they said until later, right? Because verse 26, it says, yet you were not willing to go up, but rebelled. At this point, from what we have in Deuteronomy, what have the spies said?
It was good.
So the point is, Moses is saying, you rebelled even though you have no good reason to rebel. You rebelled even if the news is just good. You're still going to rebel. Why? Because verse 32, your heart is a heart of unbelief. You are going to rebel. It doesn't matter what the spies said. You weren't going to go into the land. Period. That's it. It doesn't matter if they only bring back a good report. Now, we know that's not the full report. And later on, it does say, our brethren made our hearts melt, right? Verse 28, the people are bigger, taller, blah, 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 right? So Moses in Deuteronomy does record that that's not all the spies said. They also brought back a bad report as well. But the point is, you are rebelling even when the news is only good. Okay? Okay. So, verse 26, yet you were not willing to go up, but rebelled against the command of the Lord your God. Okay, so the spies' unbelief, their failure, they did not do what they were supposed to do, led to Israel not believing, right? Even a good report caused them to not go because the problem is their heart of unbelief, okay? The problem is their heart attitude, not the land. And look where unbelief leads you. Verse 27, you grumbled in your tents and said, because the Lord, what?
Hates us.
Does God hate them? No. Has God shown them that he's hated them? No. Unbelief twists everything. God's love and care is seen as hate. Okay? Unbelief twists God's character. I mean, and we've seen this all throughout the wilderness, right? I mean, even in Exodus wilderness before they get to Sinai, right? Every time they didn't have food or water, what was their complaint against God?
Should have left us in Egypt.
Yeah, you just brought us out of Egypt to kill us. A couple weeks later, you just brought us out of Egypt to kill us. Right? I know. Well, and he wanted to on several occasions too. Thank you, Moses, for they do. Okay, but you can see that the heart of that first generation was never changed. The same complaints they had in the wilderness are the same complaints that you're going to have now, or the same complaints they're going to have for 40 years, wandering, dying out. Why? Because they have a heart of unbelief. That is the problem. None of the rest of it is the problem. Okay, it's not their circumstances. It's not the wilderness. It's not the promised land. None of it. It's their heart of unbelief. Okay. The covenant at Sinai did nothing to change the heart of Israel. Okay? Israel focuses on the negative only. They only see the negative side, and they can only interpret that as God's hate. Verse 28, where can we go up? Okay, in verse 21, the command was to go up and take possession. In verse 28, they say, where can we go up? We can't even obey. It's not even possible. There's no place to go up, right? You just walk into the land. Like, okay, but from their point of view, obedience is impossible. God, you are expecting something that we cannot do. You're ridiculous. You just hate us, okay? They're saying there's no possible way we can obey. So their unbelief twists God's character and it exaggerates the difficulties, right? Our brethren have made our hearts melt, saying the people are bigger and taller than we. The cities are large and what? Fortified to where?
Heaven.
Okay, are they fortified to heaven? No. Okay. So their unbelief twists God's character, and then it exaggerates the things that are hard, right? So the cities are large and fortified to heaven. God, not even you can take out the cities. Besides, we saw the sons of Anakim there. There are giants in the land, right? Numbers, we look like grasshoppers to them, right? Their unbelief exaggerates the hard things. Okay? Oh, man. Okay. We're going to stop there because we're out of time, and we will finish next week.